this is a big problem for not just poker players, but entrepreneurs as well. So I think there's a few things that you can do. One is that you can become completely obsessed with process. So this is one of the things that I did as a poker player, is I was so obsessed with what's the quality of the decision? What was my bet sizing? Did I play the right hand? Like, should I even been in the hand? Did I maximize in terms of the amount of money I could get from my opponent?
Hello, darlings. Welcome to a new episode of the Venture Europe podcast. Our guest today is Annie Duke, special partner focused on decision science at First Round Capital Partners, a seed stage venture fund. Annie is a prolific author in the decision-making space, having written Thinking in Bets, a national bestseller, How to Decide, Simple Tools for Making Better Choices, and the latest book, Quit, The Power of Knowing When to Walk Away. As a former professional poker player, she has won more than $4 million, won a World Series of Poker bracelet, and is the only woman to have won the World Series of Poker Tournament of Champions and the NBC National Poker Heads Up Championship. During this episode, we discuss, you guessed, about decision-making, and also about the differences between decision quality and outcome quality, some frameworks she advises entrepreneurs to use when making decisions, and the power of mental time travel. Enjoy.
2002, which was a few years into when I was really playing poker exclusively, I got asked by a hedge fund to speak to them how poker as sort of a decision-making problem might be able to inform their thinking about risk. And when I was in graduate school, I was studying cognitive science, and judgment and decision-making sort of falls broadly, and learning falls broadly under that umbrella. And in that moment, I started thinking about sort of explicitly how poker informs judgment, decision-making, cognitive science, behavioral economics, and vice versa, and sort of dove headlong back into that discussion and conversation that I had been having really since graduate school. So I do that for many years. And then somewhere around like 2009, so I would say about 7 years as I've sort of developed this speaking business where I'm just coming and giving, like there's a suite of talks that I'm giving on the topic, I get it in my head that I ought to write two books. One book is to write an instructional poker book that was coming through the lens of decision science. And that was born of for not just sort of thinking explicitly about this conversation, but I had also been giving poker seminars and teaching poker kind of through this lens of like, how do you think about the decisions and the decision tree and trees and those kinds of things. So I really wanted to write that book. And then I wanted to write kind of the mirror image book, which was thinking about cognitive science, judgment, and decision-making through the lens of poker. So that was back in 2009. At the time, I was still a pretty active poker player. And I would say that the people didn't really know that I did this other thing. I mean, the people who were recommending me and the clients and things like that, like they knew that I was doing it, but like the broad general public doesn't know I'm doing anything related to decision-making at all. So I decide that I should write the poker book first, which I did. That got published in 2012. It's called Decide to Play Great Poker. It's a book that's poker through the lens of decision science. So then I actually ended up writing a couple other books that were poker related after that one, but always had it in my head that I was going to write from this other direction, right? How do you think about cognitive science writ large and judgment and decision-making, bias, you know, noise through the lens of poker? So finally in 2015, I think I got around to writing that proposal, sold it, and, you know, it ended up getting published in February 2018 was that book. But then I thought like, you know, I'm done. I did it. But then, you know, now I've written two more books and I've got a fourth one that I've just started. So it really was born of a love for the conversation and then wanting to write one from the poker side of things and one from the decision-making side of things.
Congratulations. And does it come from also a curiosity? Like, do you have systems in your head you would like to learn more about it, and writing also helps you clarify or learn more about it? Or is the opposite, you already think that, or you already have all the knowledge?
I don't have all the knowledge about anything. So it's definitely not the latter. So the poker book in particular, Decide to Play Great Poker, was very much informed by the former. I started teaching poker somewhere around, like doing poker seminars and whatnot. I think somewhere around like 2004 might have been the first one I did, and then started doing them like regularly starting in 2005. And what I found was it was making me so much of a better poker player. And the reason was that when you have to teach something, you're really testing your assumptions because you're saying them explicitly and out loud. And there's a big difference between sort of thinking you know it And then do I actually know it well enough to explain it to somebody? And if so, does it make any sense? And what I found was that a lot of the things that I was doing at the table that I sort of had been doing for a long time that I thought were effective and thought were correct, when I was trying to teach them to this group of, you know, intermediate poker players, I realized that these things I'm doing kind of make no sense. So it started to transform my game when I was teaching, which was really exciting. And it was mainly because I found out that a lot of the stuff that I was doing was just stupid and I ought to stop doing that. So I did. And so then obviously writing a book is even more so because you can't like wing it, right? People can go back and look and that kind of stuff. So, you know, I found that that really helped me to understand this, you know, the problem that I had been really approaching as a career for a long time. In terms of the books that I've written in cognitive science, they're teaching me maybe more than they're teaching my audience, just in terms of like gathering my thoughts, trying to figure out how to explain things coherently and whatnot. I will tell you that particularly when it comes to Thinking in Bets and Quit and the next book I'm writing, a lot of the reasons why I end up wanting to write something is because I'm sort of mad about something. If you take Thinking in Bets, right, what you can sort of see the central thing that I'm getting irked about. And it's people saying I'm a genius when they have a good result or I'm an idiot when they have a bad result. Neither of which is true. Sometimes it's true. Sometimes it's true, but not always. In this very tight connection that people are making between the quality of the result and the quality of the decision in the short run. Just something that really bugged me. It bugged me a lot as a poker player. It bugged me a lot as a business consultant. And it was just this error that I saw repeated over and over again. And while that error was certainly present and talked about in the literature, it didn't get as much play, right? Like it was like people talk about confirmation bias and all these things, but nobody was talking about this main problem, which really makes it hard to learn, right? Like it's very hard to learn if you're not actually connected, sort of teasing out this luck skill problem in results. So that was like the central thing that I was angry about that made me really want to write and explore that topic. And then when you do that, you end up learning a lot because you have to actually look at what's the scientific support and how would I interpret that and so on and so forth, which is always really exciting. And then Quit was also that I just got a bug up my, you know, this was partly coming from just understanding the importance of folding in poker, that this just complete reverence in basically any area that you can imagine in human existence, this reverence for sticking to things as sort of a goal in and of itself, as the like the end point of, you know, of character, like just this idea that, you know, if you stick to things, it's like heroic and awesome. And if you quit things, you're just a freaking loser. It really bugged me. So literally, one day I was like, oh, I really want to write about why quitting is really important. And it's a very valuable option to be able to stop what you're doing and that nobody actually does it. But that's not a whole book, right? So then I had to dive headlong into the literature, you know, things that were tangential or not. And then one of the most fun things about that is that then I get to call very smart people. And this was during the pandemic. So I got to get on Zooms with very smart people and say, hey, I'm thinking about this topic. I want to write a book about why quitting is so incredibly important that to develop, you know, as a skill, why we're bad at it, why we should care. And people were really excited about the topic. So I had a bunch of conversations with Richard Thaler, Daniel Kahneman, who just passed. I'm very incredibly sad about that. Because he and Thaler both, I mean, the book is so informed by their work and they were both incredibly generous with their time. But like, who's not going to become smarter from those kinds of conversations? You know, Phil Tetlock, Katie Milkman, Michael Mobison, like, I mean, the list goes on, right? Like Don Moore, who's amazing, Max Braverman. So now I get to talk to all these people and work the problem through with them. And just it transforms my thinking. Like I have this little germ of a thing that I'm mad about. And then it just blooms into, you know, this universe that I get to explore with incredibly smart people. So, you know, I think that's really the excitement for me is I get to scratch an itch and then learn and talk to really smart people.
I was in LA late last year for the All In Summit. And also there, it was a person teaching poker to women. And then they said how important poker is in decision-making and managing risk and thinking about career. So you were a professional poker player winning over $4 million during your career. What did poker teach you about decision-making?
What didn't it teach me? That would be a shorter answer. Here's the essential problem that we have in making almost any decision that we make in our lives. So our decisions are influenced by two forms of uncertainty. The first we can feel all the time, which is luck. This is the technical term, if people want to know what it is aleatory uncertainty. So it's just, look, when I make a decision, right, so I lock in a choice, there's different outcomes that are associated with that choice. None of those outcomes are determined, right? So there's some set of outcomes that are associated with the choice. Each of those outcomes has some probability of occurring. And the outcome that I actually end up observing just determined by luck, and it's probabilistic. So you can think about, like, if you're driving in a car and you go through a green light, there's a variety of outcomes that can occur. The one that is the most common is that you go through the intersection and everything's fine. But then there's a set of outcomes that have somebody running the red light and hitting you, or you blowing a tire, or all those things. They're rare, but there's a probability of those things occurring. So, and whether those occur, right? Like when you go through that traffic light, you don't have control of what's happening, the person coming from the other direction, and they may run the red light and it's just not in your control. And you're going to observe that outcome some amount of the time. In poker, that's really obvious. So I know that any card, the probability of any single card getting turned over on the next deal is right around 1.8, 1.9%. So you tend to, in your head, just round up to two because it's easier to multiply that. So I know, for example, that if I'm drawing for a flush and I believe that all nine, you know, I have four hearts and there's nine other hearts, that on the next card, about 18% of the time, heart will appear. And the rest of the time, it's going to be not a heart. That it could be other cards that help me and I can calculate what those are. But that tells me the probability of, we could broadly say, my hand getting help or my hand not getting help, right? So, and I know that I don't have any control over that, right? I just know that 18% of the time I'll get help and my hand will turn into a flush. If I have two cards to come, it's even better because then I get two tries at it. I'm over 30% then, yeah. But with one card to come, I would be around 18%. So I just know it's not that I have any control over what the next card is going to be. I just know that 18% of the time I'm going to observe this help happen to my hand. So in poker, it really teaches you that what that luck element really is, right? Because it's very hard in poker to make this mistake. I should have known it was going to be a heart, or I should have known it wasn't going to be a heart. It seems so nonsensical in poker to say that because you know that there's this random deal on the cards. But in life, we do that all the time. We buy a stock, it goes down. I should have known that. As if that was the only result that could have occurred. We sort of forget that there's some probability it's going to go up and some probability it's going to go down. And sometimes we're going to observe it going down and sometimes we're going to observe it going up. And on that one time, it doesn't actually really tell us whether it was a positive expected value bet to bet on that stock, right? But in poker, like, you really learn this idea. The other form of uncertainty that's influencing our decisions is what we would call epistemic uncertainty, which just simply means I know very little in comparison to all there is to be known. And this, obviously, as you can imagine, like, really hampers our decision-making, because if we were omniscient and we knew every fact there was to know, it would make decision-making a lot easier, but we're not. And so you can feel this in poker really deeply, because I can see my card, but I cannot see anybody else's card. So everybody else's cards are hidden from me. And so you're just living very deeply in this idea that you have to start to sort of make these educated guesses at, like, what are the other people holding? And you get pretty comfortable with the idea that you can't know for sure, right? That you've got to sort of do your best in that environment. So we can combine that to say, we're not omniscient and we don't have a time machine, and that makes decision-making hard. And those two problems of not knowing the next card that's going to come and not knowing what you are holding are so present, like, so hyper-present in poker, that when you become good in that environment, boy, does it teach you how to deal with decision-making in general. And then you can lay on top of that this very interesting thing that I think is probably the number one thing that poker really teaches you, is how completely sideways our decision-making can go under these conditions of uncertainty, particularly as it relates to the luck element. Because this luck element presents this particular problem, which is, when I get a result, I win or lose a hand. I have to determine what the contribution is of luck and what the contribution is of skill. And that's actually quite hard to do in the short run. It's easy to do in the long run when you have a big enough sample size, but it's really hard to do in the short run. What I figured out pretty quickly just from my own errors and then watching other people is that when there's a lot of short-term luck in a system in which you're deciding, it's really easy to make luck an excuse in order to protect your self-image, which is related to your sort of psychological well-being, right? What you'll see poker players do all the time, and I certainly was not immune to this in any way, is when they win, they played great. And when they lose, they got unlucky. Short run, that feels great. Because no matter what, I'm an amazing decision maker. I'm an incredible player. But long run, that it's a disaster for trying to become better at what you're doing. But it's the system, right? The system is allowing you to do that. It's giving you the leeway to misinterpret things in a way that confirm my prior beliefs about myself or confirm my identity, that reinforce that positive self-image that I'm trying to support of myself. And so I think that in order to become a really great poker player, you have to actually just get over that as best as you can, like better than your peers, and be much more focused on not worrying about whether I won or lost. Like what I really care about was, did I screw this hand up or not? And I think that's probably like the, in terms of overarching, like poker's teaching you just sort of in the system what it means to make high stakes decisions when luck is going to influence things. And, you know, and you can't see your opponent's cards. You don't have all the facts, actually. But then like this broad problem of luck gives you a lot of rope, a lot of leeway to start to for these things that, you know, people like Kahneman-Tversky and Thaler and whatnot, like these cognitive biases and heuristics, which are errors in human judgment, right? For those really to sort of like grab on and like take root and grow in that environment, because it is so short term, like very noisy. And I just became obsessed with that topic because poker really teaches you that.
I coach a lot of entrepreneurs, and I definitely see a bias or an overlap between decision quality and outcome quality.
For absolutely.
Right? If they took a decision and then the outcome is good, to your point, their self-image, I'm so smart. But whereas like if we're an entrepreneur and just so many ups and downs, how do you think we should look at it and not have our self-image affected, knowing that the decision quality was good regardless if the outcome was not good?
So I think there's a couple of things that you can do. So let me just say 100% outcomes are completely determined by decision quality in the long run for any game that has skill involved. So, I mean, if you're playing the lottery, it doesn't matter in the long run. You're going to lose, like whatever, like that. That's a game of pure luck. But assuming that there's skill in a game, if you have a large enough N, the outcome will actually map back onto the quality of the decisions that you made over some period of time. I want to be clear about that. Like we're talking about a short-term problem here. So this is a big problem for not just poker players, but entrepreneurs as well. So I think there's a few things that you can do. One is that you can become completely obsessed with process. So this is one of the things that I did as a poker player. Is I was so obsessed with what's the quality of the decision? What was my bet sizing? Did I play the right hand? Like, should I even been in the hand? Did I maximize in terms of the amount of money I could get from my opponent? And in order to do that, there's a couple of things that have to happen. One is that you have to get other people in on it with you. So this is really, really important. And it becomes important for a second reason as well, which I'll get to. And the reason that you have to get other people in on it is that other people are often going to see the decision more clearly than you are. And so if you want to actually get down into decision quality, having other people that you can sort of bounce the decisions off of is really important. But then you have to talk about your decisions in a different way. So if I want to get your advice on a hand and I'm really obsessed, right? I'm super obsessed with process. I have to describe the hand to you in a way where I'm not biasing your answer toward me. In poker, normally the way that someone would describe a hand, they'd be like, Callan raised and then I re-raised and then he called and then the board came ace, 9-3 and I had ace, queen and he checked and I bet and he raised me and I did that, blah, 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 all the way till the end of the hand. Now notice that by doing it that way, you now know every opinion that I had because whether I raise or call or how much or whatever is my own judgment, you also know how everything turned out. it's very difficult for you, even as someone who's trying to be an honest broker here, to now actually really dig into process with me if I've gotten you all the way to the hand and then I'm asking you to tell me what you think about it. What I would have to do then is say, Colin raised, he was in first position, whatever. He's like very, he was active. I looked down and I had ace queen. And I'd say, what do you think I should have done? So notice now I haven't biased you in any way and we actually just get to dig in, right? So that's going to help me to actually think about process. I'm going to hear from you in a non-judgmental way, right? Because you're not actually contradicting me, what you think I should have done. And now I can just actually sort of delve into that in a way that allows me to learn from that. Now, notice that requires me to actually have a good record of the decision that I made. In this particular case, as a poker player, I've trained myself to remember all of this stuff. But it's a lot better if you're actually writing down why are you making the decision? What's the information? What's the set of opinions that's going into it? How are you modeling those facts and things like that? So you can feed those things back to somebody and say, here's the state of knowledge that I was in at the time that I made the decision. Because remember, you're going to learn new stuff after the fact, not just new information, but a lot just like, how did the luck go? Right. So I tell you that I'm drawing for a flush and then I tell you a blank came, meaning no heart, for example, a blank came on the turn and blank came on the river. You're more likely, knowing how it actually turned out, to interpret my moves as poor. But I don't want you to do that. I want you to be in the same state of knowledge that I was at the time. So that's one thing that we can do, is sort of like get a group of people together where we're really bouncing decisions off of each other in a non-judgmental way, not to say that we made a mistake, but because we have a mindset shift that I want to be able to get better at what I'm doing, because in the long run, that's going to map onto my decision quality. And that's really what I care about. And so I'm going to figure out a system for doing that. And then the second thing is, and this is related now to having this group, is that I think that we do have some control over what it is that we're deriving our sort of positive view of ourselves from. And it comes from something very, very deep about decision-making, about tribe rather. So when we think about the things that tribe is giving us, among other things, giving us two things which give us a sense of well-being. One is a sense of belongingness. In other words, I belong to a tribe. And the other, and this is something that we see in our politics a lot today, is a sense of distinctiveness. In other words, I am not those people. Right? Both of those things are actually integral to our identities and to feeling good about who we are. And I think that you can actually use that to your advantage in this decision-making way, right? Think about it this way. Well, the normal person, they derive their positive self-image by just blindly trying to affirm that they're, you know, that they make great decisions. And that one makes them feel good. So when things go well, they think it's great, which might be bad, because sometimes things go well after luck, because of luck rather. And when things go poorly, they're like, that wasn't my fault. And that's what they do, because that makes them feel good in the short run. But that is not what I do. I am willing to feel bad in the short run, quote, because I know that I'm focused on the long run and becoming a better decision maker. And that's what makes me distinct from other people. So in poker, when, you know, I would walk the halls after a poker tournament, you know, on the break of a poker tournament or whatever, and I would hear people say, oh, I can't believe how unlucky I got. I totally outplayed that donkey, which is a derogatory term for a bad player. I totally outplayed that donkey and I should have won the hand, but like I got so unlucky. And I would hear that and I would say, haha, they've fallen into the trap that I'm not falling into because I don't do that. So it's like, I would love it if everybody could just put that aside and just be super zen. But I actually think that it's unrealistic to expect people to be able to do that. So if you can't do it, then you should try to figure out a way to use that to get to the goal that you actually want to get to. So now I get to be part of a tribe where my sense of belongingness to that tribe and distinctiveness from other people is derived from saying, no. What I really want to know is, did I play the hand well? And I'm willing, even if I won a hand, for you to tell me I played it like crap. Because that's what has to come with that, right? And then that has to make me feel good. And so that's sort of, you know, how I ended up engineering.
So if we look at the decision quality, and then we should be aware that then the outcome has some luck and some things that actually we didn't know, how much information do you think is enough? Like, how do you decide the amount of information from, let's say, buying an apartment? You know that the price might go up or down. You still try to do your research. What's the price per square meter? What would you like to pay? Or if you're a founder, you want to hire, like, let's say, an executive. You get all the information, let's say some referrals, you read their CVs, you have the interviews, but you still know that you did everything in your process to guarantee the decision quality is high, and you know that you have no control on the outcome. But then how much information do you think is enough to gather in the equation of luck and the things that you know and things that you don't know?
The answer is it's not one size fits all. It depends on the decision. So let me just give you two big concepts that tell you what the answer to this is. The first concept is impact, and the second concept is optionality. So we want to think about things through the lens of impact and optionality. Impact is basically what's the long-term impact if I get a bad outcome? And optionality is, if I see that a bad outcome is occurring, can I stop what I'm doing? That's actually, I wrote about that, this concept in thinking and how to decide, rather. And that's what made me write Quit, was that one bit, that little piece of like, can I stop it? Okay, so why does that matter for decision speed, right? As we're thinking about these two things, we can basically think about this. The more time that we spend on a decision translate effort, the more time slash effort that we spend on a decision is going to be correlated with error reduction. So it's not perfect, right? Like, we could spend a lot of time on a decision and actually sometimes introduce more error, but mostly the faster that we decide, the more error we're likely to be introducing into the decision. The slower that we decide, we should be reducing error on average. Okay. So what that means is that in order to figure out how much effort, how much time, how much process am I supposed to put into this decision, we have to ask ourselves, how much error can I tolerate? And that's what brings us to impact and optionality. The lower the long-term impact of a bad outcome, the more error you're allowed to introduce into the decision, because it's not, it doesn't, just doesn't have as big an effect. So you shouldn't really care. The more that you can reverse the decision, again, that's a way to mitigate impact, right? Because you're not stuck in the decision, you can get out of it. Again, you should be more willing to decide pretty fast. So how do we think about impact? Well, the thing we don't want to do is just think like, how much of a disaster is this going to feel like when it happened? Because like, as Daniel Kahneman said, nothing is as important as it feels when you're thinking about it. So we know that in the immediate aftermath of getting a bad outcome, it's the worst thing on earth and you're the unluckiest person ever. And why does this happen to you? So we don't want to think about it this way. We want to think about it in the long run. So that what I like to talk about is like, if you are at a restaurant and you're sort of agonizing over the menu and what dish you should order, and then you finally decide on one and you get it and it's bad food, you immediately are berating yourself and saying, I made a mistake. That was so stupid. Blah, blah, blah. Right. And then we've all run into people who take 15 minutes to make that decision. And, you know, it's just like, oh, right. What you don't want, of course, it feels bad when you order something and it's crappy. Right. But does it have a bad long-term impact on you? And the answer to that is no. Because if I ask you how much that's actually going to affect your overall level of happiness over the next year, the answer is zero. And in fact, if I ask you over the next month, the answer is also zero. And even over the next week, it's probably zero. So we always want to think about long-term impact. So I like to think about this as like the intern versus CFO problem, dating versus marrying, right? So if I hire an intern and they're not great, which is a bad outcome, probably not going to have really any effect on the success of my business. But if I hire a CFO and they're not great, it's going to have a big effect. If I go on one date and kind of the, you know, so what? If I get into a bad marriage, huge impact. So that's impact. And then you can see in these same frameworks, that optionality piece, very easy to let go of an intern, that's super easy to do, hard to let go of a CFO, very easy to get out of a date, very hard to get out of a marriage, right? So we can see how those two things are related to each other. So once we understand those two things, basically it's figure out that, and then that tells you how much you're supposed to work on the decision, how much process you're supposed to sit on top of the decision. So if you're hiring a CFO, or like I work with Inventure, deciding to invest in a company, it's a very big decision. You know, in any single fund, you might have between 20 and 40 bets total. It's a big decision. So you should take some time with that. That's very important to take a lot of time with. Hiring an intern, you should take very little time with. And so that's really like, you just, once you start to think about it through that framework, it becomes very easy to see, like, I should spend time over here, but not over here.
What is your take on intuition in decision making? Famously, Jeff Bezos says that you have to take the decision with 60-70% of the data, because if you wait until you have all the data, then it's too late. How do you think intuition plays into it, given that we're irrational actors?
So here's the thing about intuition is sometimes it's good, and then a lot of times it's bad. So when Jeff Bezos is saying you just have to make the decision with 70% of the information, he's not saying you're going with your intuition. He's saying you got to 70% certainty. By the way, he's 100% right. Like, don't go beyond that, because that's an illusion, because you can't even get to it. You might think you can get to 90%, but you can't. And at some point, you got to decide, right? But on the intuition side, again, like sometimes your intuition is pretty good, and sometimes it's really bad. The problem is that if we sort of leave the decision with our gut, there's no way for us to know if it's really good or if it's really bad, because we know it can be both things. The way that I think about intuition is twofold. One, low impact, easy to reverse decisions. I don't care. Go with your gut. It just, like, don't take the time. Do as little as possible. It doesn't really matter to me. Like, if you're hiring an intern, honestly, have some minimum requirements that you figure out, like, what are their grades have to be? Are there any red flags in the recommendations? Whatever. You know, that maybe you get 10 people who look pretty good. I don't care if you go with your gut, you flip a coin. I really don't care how you decide beyond that, right? Like, they met the threshold. It was a pretty low threshold. Do whatever your gut tells you. I don't care. I really don't. But beyond that, once you get to something where you actually do want to, and even with the intern one, you're doing a little bit of process, right? But where you really do feel like you need some process in there, I don't care if the way that you structure that decision is initially formed by your intuition about how you model that type of problem. Because what I want you to do is take whatever your intuition is telling you and make it explicit. So this is what's key. Because I think that when people say, oh, you know, I have good intuition, I go with my gut, what they mean is they literally are just deciding with their gut. But the problem is that I don't know what your gut is doing, which is bad for you, because if there's an error that maybe I could have easily spotted, you don't get the benefit of that. It's bad for me also, because if you're actually really good at what you do, you don't get to teach me. Both of those things are bad. So let me give you an idea of, like, the process, and then where intuition should really, I think, come in a big decision. So I am a special partner at First Round Capital. We have a decision rubric. V1 of the decision rubric was individually writing to each of the partners and saying, hey, when you're thinking about investing in a company, what are the things that you're thinking about? How do you model that problem? What do you think makes a good company to invest in? What are the things that you're really looking to see it would be disqualifying, you know, so on and so forth. So we're getting this general, each person individually is saying, this is how we model the problem. This is how we think about it. So you could think about that as I'm asking for them to explicitly tell me what their gut is doing, right? Like, they have some gut feel for what makes a good investment. And I'm saying, explicitly tell me what this is. Okay, so we do that. So that's V1 is being generated from that. Now notice I'm getting 6 different opinions about that. So that's the thing that's really good, is that I want your gut to collide with my gut, which is just your model to collide with my model, if we're both really good, because that's going to improve it and take it a little bit more out of intuition. But we do that. And now we take all that information and we create a rubric out of it. So let's say broadly, we're saying everybody says quality of the market, quality of the founder, quality of the team, quality of the product. Within each of those, we have things about what they believe makes a good product, what they believe makes a good founder, so on and so forth. Okay, so now we've got a decision rubric that's built out of that. And then that also includes some forecasts that we know you would be making, again, intuitively. So a good example would be when I first was talking to them, I had suggested that I thought it would be a good idea for, they invested seed. I thought it'd be a good idea for them to forecast the probability that the company that they're looking at will successfully fund a Series A. What they said to me was, and I understand because I'd heard this from a lot of people, this wasn't special to them, but we're not investing for a successful Series A, we're investing for an exit. And I said to them, well, have you ever invested in a company at seed that didn't raise a Series A that ended up being a fund returner? And of course they said no. And what I said was, well, then what that means is that intuitively, when you're making the decision about whether to invest, you are indeed making this forecast. In the same way that if I'm deciding when to leave for the airport, I'm making a forecast of how long it's going to take me to get there. And the question is just, do we leave that in the sort of intuitive realm, or do we make that explicit? And in every place, we want to make that explicit. So now we're just taking this intuition that's left implicit. We're making that all explicit so that everybody can sort of see, you have this model, I have this model. Let's try to sort of figure out how those go together. And then when we're making the decision now, we're actually going to be judging the opportunity based on these factors, which are now explicit. But remember, this is all the stuff that they were doing implicitly anyway, which is now going to be explicit. So that's sort of the first thing. Then once they do all that explicit work, that's now where what we think of as your intuition is going to add value. In other words, you've done all this explicit work, and then you say, but something still bothers me. We should pay attention to that, right? That's something we should pay attention to, but we should ask, what is it that bothers you? So we make that explicit. Of course, once you've done this and revved this over and over and over again, now you get enough data where you can actually go back to that original rubric and start to say, this is predictive, this isn't. Even though intuitively they thought this was an important factor, this factor isn't actually predictive of how the company ends up unfolding, so on and so forth. And you can start to refine it once you start to collect data that you can feed back in. But that original one is basically saying, look, your intuition's probably pretty good. You're expert investors. But if we make it explicit, it's going to be even better. And just like when I started playing poker, I figured out that a lot of things that I'd been doing intuitively with my gut that I thought were brilliant, when I had to start teaching it and saying it explicitly and exposing it to other people who could ask me questions about it, I found out, wow, that was dumb. And that's what we're trying to always get to.
That's awesome. Do you also work with founders? Yeah. What are like two or three frameworks that you teach them? I know that probably we covered some of them.
Well, that we have, I would say that the two frameworks that I think are probably the most valuable. The first one is called Monkeys and Pedestals. This comes from Astro Teller over at X. Monkeys and Pedestals, I think, is a really important way to understand, like, how should I, you know, what projects should I put in flight? What, you know, what products should I develop? How should I attack developing these things? So it goes like this. Imagine you're trying to train a monkey to juggle flaming torches while standing in a town square on top. So obviously you would make lots of money if you could actually do that. And we can think about that there's two pieces to this puzzle. The first is, can I train the monkey to juggle flaming torches? And the second is, can I build the pedestal, right? And so it's, which thing should you do first? And we put it this way. Most people will say, well, I think that you should probably figure out if you can train the monkey to juggle those flaming torches. And there's three really important reasons why you should do that. One is that the monkey is the unknown, right? I know that I can build a pedestal. I don't know if I can train the monkey. And so you should always go for the unknown first, because if you start to attack the thing that you already know you can do first, you're actually creating an illusion of progress. Because if I'm building a pedestal, I'm not actually making any progress because I already know I can do it. Whereas if I'm working on training the monkey, I'm actually making progress because I'm learning things that I don't know already. Second is that there's no point in having the pedestal if you can't train the monkey. So the monkey is the bottleneck. So the monkey is the unknown, and it's also the bottleneck. And if you can't unclog that bottleneck, there's no point in having the pedestal anyway. And then the third, and this is a really important point, is that if you start building pedestals, which aren't solving for any bottlenecks and are creating the illusion of progress, having done that, it will be very hard for you to quit when you actually butt up against a monkey that's really hard to solve. Now, less people think this is obvious and clearly how they approach projects and product development. No, because I bet you that everybody has been in a meeting where they hear the phrase, what's the low-hanging fruit? And the low-hanging fruit by definition are pedestals. Yeah. And we love to start there because we like to feel the progress right away. So we can think about someone who starts coding before they start doing customer interviews, right? Like I can code. Yeah. Coding is a pedestal. Trust me. And if I'm a good coder, I can code it. So if I just start building, I'm not actually making any progress, right? The first thing I need to do is go ask people if they want it, right? So I have this great idea. I have to go ask people if they want it. Then I need to build smartly, only enough to go find out the next piece of information I need to know what I'm supposed to do next, right? And so this is how we're supposed to build out these things. Now, I can tell you a good example of this mistake being made in a very big way, so that people understand like how common the mistake is to not go monkeys first. The Hyperloop was pitched to Astro Teller, and they came in and pitched it. People left. And they talked about it over at X, and they did, they do this for everything. They did a monkeys and pedestals exercise on it. And they said, okay, well, I think we know what the pedestal is. And the pedestal was the system, which is interesting because the Hyperloop itself, can you actually move something through vacuum tube tech? We know we can. So interestingly, in this case, it's a very expensive pedestal, but a pedestal nonetheless, because it's not the unknown. They felt that there were two unknowns. One was just regulatory. Can you actually get every township that this thing would go through? The Hyperloop, for people who don't know, is a train that's supposed to take you from New York to LA in 2.5 hours. I forgot to add that part in. Through vacuum tube technology, suck you through in a train in a vacuum tube. Okay, so they know they can build the system. That's not an issue, but they don't know if they'll be able to get the townships along the way to agree to have the system running through it. That's problem number one. Problem number two, which was more serious, was they didn't know, given how fast the train would be moving, if you would kill everybody on board when you got it up to speed and when you went to stop it. So they did some quick back of the envelope calculations, and they figured out that you would have to build nearly the whole system before you could get any kind of true safety test. So they just, on that basis, they just decided it wasn't for them. They didn't want to build a ginormous and incredibly expensive pedestal to answer the safety monkey, let's call it the safety monkey. So they said no, and it took them 15 minutes to decide it wasn't for them. Virgin did end up doing it, and they're well over 60 million in. They're on their way to 160 million in. They haven't had any real safety tests because they've only been able to build 1/6 of the system. So they have no safety test. They're running up against a huge regulatory problem with trying to get right of way and townships to agree to have this. So remember I said the third problem with starting with pedestals is that if you start there and then you run sort of butt up against a monkey that you can't train, it's very hard to stop. So Virgin, millions and millions of dollars in, has now butted up against these monkeys. And instead of stopping, they're shifting to making it a cargo train. So now they're now slated to spend $160 million on a cargo train that will get things from New York to LA in 2.5 hours, which is not the reason that they were building it. And it's because they did not go monkeys first. They didn't think about the monkeys in advance. So now we can see the difference. One company has $160 million in. The other one had 15 minutes in because they went monkeys first. So it just allows you to, how am I supposed to attack that? So that's idea number one, framework number one. Framework number two is something called kill criteria, which is related, which is once you start things, it's really hard to stop. See Virgin in the Hyperloop for details on that. So when you start something, you always want to have a quitting plan associated with it. And the best way to do that is to create kill criteria, which is to say in advance, if I observe these certain things happening in the world, I will stop what I'm doing. And that's one of the most powerful things you can do, whether it comes to, you know, when should you pivot? When should you shift your go-to-market? When should you let somebody go who isn't performing? When should you change sales strategies? Like whatever it is, like it's going to apply across your whole business. Just this idea of, look, think in advance, what are the signals that I might see in the future that would tell me that it's time to stop? Write those down, commit to doing that. And then you're more likely to be freeing yourself up to explore more fruitful opportunities more quickly.
Love that. And also, like, I think this kind of ties a little bit, and it's easier to make the decision before you are into the middle of the decision.
Yeah. So one of the really big things that's, I think, like, I find it very fascinating about decision making is that it feels like there should literally be no difference between seeing a signal that you ought to stop at the time that it shows up and deciding, or imagining that signal occurring sometime in the future, writing it down and committing to do something when you see it. Like, why are those two things different? But they are. They're really different. Yeah. And I think that that's just a really important thing to understand about decision making, is the more that you can engage in mental time travel and kind of plan in advance. And that's also true for what are you going to do when you see good stuff happen as well. And then, you know, make these sort of pre-commitments to what you're going to do under those circumstances, the better off you're going to be for sure.
Annie, thank you. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Awesome. It was so nice chatting with you.